Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the last full weekend of November 2019, just 4 weeks away from the winter solstice. Days are definitely short, and that is accentuated by the heavy cloud layers we've been seeing here. They've been serving to keep the temperatures very moderate, with some days not even seeing a low temperature as low as the normal for the date high temperature. So it's been a little interesting and a lot of rain. We've been making up for some of the dryness earlier in the year, well above average, several inches above average for the month so far of November. So it's, definitely been a wet and warm November. It looks like the temperatures are supposed to drop in the coming days, so I'll look forward to seeing the snow come down the mountains again. This past week was the eighth season that we had Gwen Bayliss in town to band some birds for the Sitka Bird Banding Project, focused on dark-eyed juncos, chestnut-backed chickadees, and song sparrows, each of which get color band combinations. We'll join the conversation that she and I recorded with her, explaining a little bit about the aluminum band that each of the bird gets, regardless of colors.
Everybody gets a metal band with a unique number, just in case they get captured somewhere else, or unfortunately get hit on the road or something, someone can get that band number, and then it goes to, if they turn it into the bird banding laboratory, then they have all the numbers and they can let me know where it ended up, and I can let them, whoever they are that finds the bird, I can let them know where it got banded. So it's always good to get that information. With the color reciting, of course, we can get information without having to actually catch the bird.
I imagine that probably most cases when a band is getting recited, it's a dead bird or somebody else recaptured.
Another bander
basically
catches it, yeah.
Yeah.
It gets the number.
Have you had many recaptures of, I know you've banded more than just this project, but mm-hmm. do you get a lot of recaptures in from the birds you've banded?
Not that many. It is kind of a needle in the haystack. But there have been a few interesting ones over the years. You know, we got a sparrow and up in Yakutat, a Lincoln sparrow that had been banded down in Oregon on his migration route.
Oh, so in some cases you're the one getting
I was the receiver of the bird. There was a rufous hummingbird. That's lately over in Juneau. I haven't been banding many songbirds. I've been banding the hummingbirds. And so there was the rufous hummingbird female that I banded in early July, right as she was migrating, actually already out of Juneau. And she was caught a week later in southeastern Alberta at the Lesser Slave Lake. They have a bird observatory there. It's part of the Canadian monitoring system of migration stations. And it was actually a misnet that she went into. I have little hoop traps for the hummingbirds that I catch them in, but this was, she just happened to be there. The odds of that are really overwhelming.
Yeah. Only a week later.
So she was going over 100 miles a day.
So that was, is that close to 1,000 miles, or is it more than that? Or
yeah, I don't remember exactly.
In that neighborhood.
Yeah, I just remember calculating it was something like 107 miles a day that she would have had to crank to make it to southeastern Alberta from Juneau in a week. So that was one of the more exceptional recaptures of one of my birds. Over in the stations that I help with over in the Yukon, they've had quite a few interesting recaptures of their birds. Not sure if they were ones that I helped band or not, they do thousands. So you do need to do thousands usually to get a lot. But they had reports from Brazil for an alder flycatcher, I think. And they had a yellow warbler. I think that one was like the Texas Gulf area. I think they may have also had a yellow warbler all much farther south in South America as well. I believe they had another report from Brazil. I don't remember what it was, but maybe it was a Swainson's thrush. Not sure, but for sure the older flycatcher. That was a really, really great one, and they go so far.
Wow. it's hard. I mean, I know that in principle, but it's kind of in practice thinking about an individual bird, you know, flying those many thousand miles. It's a lot of country in between. I know a number of them. I don't know if those particular species that you mentioned are primarily nighttime migrators, but a number of them migrate. A number of species migrate at night. I know in the Midwest, in the Rockies, there are folks that will listen at night, you know, go out and sometimes record or sometimes just listen for the night flight calls, which we do get hear some, but we don't have so much diversity.
Yeah, a lot
migrants.
Of them will be recorded going by at night, mm-hmm. which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to think about the river of migrants. I guess I was talking to Bill Foster a few years ago, and he was telling me about the old school techniques, you know, before you had recording, mm-hmm. digital recorders and that kind of thing, that I guess one of the ways of estimating nighttime migrant volume was on a night of a full moon, you'd take your spotting scope and you just count how many flew across the moon, and you could then extrapolate.
You could tell it was a big night.
For how many were probably moving through. Now weather radar shows, I think there are techniques for estimating kind of quantity of birds based on the how they're showing up on weather radar.
Right, yeah. They can actually get a lot of information about the different flocks of birds. I think they can tell kind of the relative size, so you know if it's a flock of like a waterfowl or songbirds. I think they can even detect dragonfly migration.
Oh, wow.
I think that's more prevalent over in Europe, but there are these big swarms of migrant dragonflies.
Huh. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I one of the things I like to do is watch especially in the spring and to a lesser extent in the fall, usually because it's rainy, but the weather radar at Bjorka Island here. And of course, Marinoff Island is a big barrier, so you don't see what's happening in Chatham Strait on the east side. But you do see the river of migrants heading north in the spring and mm-hmm. south in the fall. And it actually starts, like the first kind of inklings of it, I suspect, are gulls or waterfowl moving around. It's kind of patchy, but I've seen it in March. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of why I think like the gulls are repositioning for herring and the waterfowl mm-hmm. just kind of seem to get an early move on things. But by April, late April, certainly in May, it's just every night. And it's right after sunset, and it's just this kind of bloom comes up. Everything's headed north. And then just before sunset, it dies down, or just after sunrise, I should say. And one thing I've noticed is that you can actually see a little bit of a signal of things that started across Sitka Sound and were like, oh, no, never mind.
And they,
in the fall, they're headed south and they go, oh, retreat back to Khruzhov Island. And I thought, you know, it might be interesting to just be on the shoreline of Khruzhov Island and at that south shoreline in the fall and just see, are things like, can you see them flying back?
Yeah.
I don't really know how many birds are that really is, but it's kind of fascinating to think about all those birds moving over, just this constant stream and some of them landing here and being here, but I don't really know what sometimes we get these fallout sort of things where there's lots of birds around, mm-hmm. sparrows or whatever. But other times it's just quiet and it's like something's there because every night it's clear and presumably nights that it's not, but you can't tell on the weather radar if it's raining. But every night that it's not raining, you can see this river of birds.
That's really
just moving
cool.
And you're like, well.
Yeah.
And they don't go offshore. You know, fishing boats will get them offshore. So I think there mm-hmm. are clearly individual birds that are going offshore, but there's no signal consistently on the radar that they're all coming along just kind of the coastline of
just hugging the Baranoff coastline
and kind of over Khruzhov. But and I imagine that there's at least as many, if not more, going on the inside through Chatham Strait and near the mainland.
Yeah, maybe, but it could actually be less. Mm. There's something about outer coasts that a lot of birds just hug that line. So that would be really cool to compare. I don't know how we would get that data.
Right.
But, I suspect that there's stuff going on the outer coast that doesn't happen on the inside.
Yeah. I guess part of the reason I think that is because there's particular species that I don't see out here that I know are prevalent. Ketchikan,
right.
Juno,
yeah.
Sea regularly.
There's probably other species that actually do avoid
the Bonaparte's
outer coast.
Gulls are an example. I mean, you get hundreds of them, right?
Yeah.
Ketchikan gets thousands.
Yeah.
And we're lucky if we see 50 in a season, we're like, whoa, that's a great year for Bonaparte's.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I guess they don't like the big wind or whatever it is that's out here.
Something.
There's something they eat that's on the inside. I don't know.
But I've heard that on Chatham side, there's lots of them, and clearly in Ketchikan and Juneau. So some things seem to come up Chatham. Like, they don't like to cross Chatham at that south end. They're coming up Prince of Wales, and they're like, oh, no, thank you. And then they stay inside.
We'll go inside.
And then maybe cut across where it's a bit more narrow and go up Peril Straits across the central part of Chichikov, or maybe even go up to Icy Strait and then mm-hmm. hook around there.
Yeah,
and,
I'm not
and
sure
the
what they do exactly.
Yeah, it would be fascinating to know, but it would be, I guess you'd have to have a GPS thing that mm-hmm. was that was a pretty rapid to fire thing. So not so great for small birds.
No.
But yeah, it is the bird migration thing is pretty fascinating. And I know that for like our project, one of the things that we've been interested in is the song sparrows and juncos both. Where are they going? I mean, it's clear that the juncos in particular are all gathering up in the wintertime around our feeders in town. So we see lots and lots of them. And it's hard to count them because I discovered through this project, it's more like, you know, to go back to the river analogy, it's more like a river of juncos moving through the feeding stations. You know, I imagine they're a flock, but then it's like you band a bunch of them and there's just as many as there were before, but there are no banded birds.
Yeah.
Okay, something's happening here.
Yeah.
But then they got to go somewhere. And so we haven't had too many summer re-sightings of these banded birds.
Yeah, just a few. So Sitka's definitely a destination for juncos from probably a lot of parts of Southeast Alaska. And then we know from the odd sort of slate color or hybrid between slate color and Oregon junco that some of them are coming from east, you know, probably from the Yukon and the mountains between us and the Yukon and northern BC. So we know some of those come over. And then we had our one bird that ended up in Juneau.
Yeah, that was kind of exciting.
From Sitka in the winter.
Was that a spring one?
It was actually spring. So it was possibly on its way to wherever it was ultimately going. But if it was going through Juneau, I think we can guess that it was, you know, it headed east and then it was either going to go up the mountain or to another place around Juneau. And yeah, we didn't see it again in that neighborhood. But that doesn't mean it was really necessarily all that far away. It just wasn't in a neighborhood, so no one saw it after that.
Yeah. We have seen, I think, two or three banded juncos here in the summer that I think at least one of which was feeding young.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests that some of the birds are resident year-round.
Yeah, some of them are fully resident, but some of them obviously are not.
Yeah.
So we get a mixing of the juncos.
And I guess if we wanted to target resident birds, then you'd have to come into breeding territories and ban the birds that were nesting. And I guess I would be curious. I wouldn't guess that there is, but I'd be curious if there was some difference between fully resident birds and migrant birds that are coming and going. You know, either genetically, if there's a structure to the population, or if there's you'd have to get so many of them to start teasing out size differences, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, in general, the longer winged birds are more the migrants, or at least the longer primary projection, like the pointier wings. So you can measure the difference between the longest primary feather and the longest secondary feather. And that's going to be a bigger difference, a more pointy wing in the longer distance migrants. Mm. And there is some evidence of that in the East Coast juncos. They've banded enough of them, I think. That there is a difference between the ones that migrate more and the ones that migrate less. But almost all of the slate color juncos migrate a fair distance back there. But then they do have some, like these, I think it's North Carolina, they have some that are a more of a resident bird or a little bit different. And like here seems to be, there's places that are going to be mostly males and mostly females. So they had really good evidence of the youngest males wintering the farthest north and then the older males followed by, I think, the younger females and the older females, so that you had kind of a partitioning by age and sex. And something could be happening like that on the Pacific Coast, which might explain why we still have banded a lot more males than females and a lot more younger birds than older birds. You always have more younger birds in the fall anyway because they reproduce highly. And so, you know, the young guys are going to outnumber the old guys in the fall. And then they don't necessarily all survive. So in the spring, it's closer to closer ratio. But you know, that we got a lot of females today, by the way.
Oh. So
we were kind of, it was a little different, but even so, overall for Sitka, it's a lot more males that we've caught.
Well, it seems to be, it's an interesting thing. I don't remember the details enough now to be sure, but were you finding, I know you've banded on Galenican Island and you've banded at various spots around along the road system. And I can't remember how much detail we looked at this in, but were there differences in the location between the sex ratios that you were capturing?
Yeah.
Or the age?
It seems like there might have been, but I'm not sure we have enough sample, especially from the islands, to really say anything. It seems like more female and older birds were caught on the islands.
Yeah.
But we don't really have enough, a big enough sample size. So I kind of just looked at Sitka as a whole.
Right.
Considering it one kind of region.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider whether or not there might be even finer. Well, and if there is, then that makes you wonder about some of the other studies, if they happen to get the pocket of...
how much is it a pocket?
But right.
I doubt it's that
right.
strong. I think they did, you know, like we have move around to a few different stations. And plus you have your birds moving around for you, you know, cruising.
Well, and it would be quite a coincidence to have that gradation happening and, you know, coincidentally hitting the different pockets in different places.
Right. That would be pretty amazing. Yeah. So I think statistically there's pretty good evidence that the birds are petitioning, not perfectly, but
right.
a trend.
Yeah. Is there a hypothesis or sense of why that might be the case?
I don't think anyone really knows, but and it's not just juncos. There's many species that it's been recorded that you have males and females having slightly different wintering areas. One reason might be just it's one way of reducing competition, so that you have half the number of birds competing with each other in any given spot. And if your males and females are a little bit dimorphic, a little bit different in, say, their bill length, then maybe they're a little better adapted to a different, slightly different habitat. So that's one theory. I don't know if there's other ones.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I've been in, I mean, as you mentioned, most of the birds are young birds, and that's true. Like if you're learning gulls, like mm-hmm. I was it, like 50% of most of the gulls you see are either full adult or they're full juvenile. You know, that those second and third cycle gulls are the, because you can accumulate gulls once they hit that adult stage, they stay there, and then you have this big influx of hatchier birds that aren't often with high survival rates. So we have a lot of young birds, but we have had a number of resightings, both resightings and recaptures, more resightings than recaptures of these color-banded birds. So clearly some of the birds are coming here winter after winter. And I guess it makes me wonder a little bit about what we've seen so far is that the ones that we are resighting seem to be in the same neighborhood as they were banded. So it makes some sense. It's funny that before we started doing this project, I sort of was like, oh, they just go all over, wherever. But now that I'm seeing that the song sparrows are like super specific and the juncos are at least staying in the same neighborhood, I'm like, yeah, I guess it's pretty obvious and it makes sense. Why would they go to some place that's unknown with unknown hazards when they can go to a place that's familiar with known hazards and they know their way around?
Right. There's an increasing body of evidence, especially with a lot of the even the tropical studies that go on in the winter, that even these really long distance migrants, once they find a place that they like, they will come right back, and you can recapture them in the same net that you put in the exact same spot years in a row.
That's what,
and it's pretty amazing for especially it's one thing for a junco that maybe went 50 miles or 100
right.
miles or even 200 miles, but imagine the bird that went 2,000 miles and he's like, oh, there's my tree.
Yeah. It is kind of, I remember Allison Nelson, who was up here to band hermit thrushes and works with hermit thrushes in California, saying they caught at one station there, Point Reyes, I think, they caught the same hermit thrush in the same net, like the same placement net, like 8 years in a row or something
wow,
like that.
Yeah.
Right around the same time.
Yeah, that was his spot.
Yeah, just like, well, all right. And I guess it makes sense that that's the case. And so, I mean, it's interesting to think about this. Well, the younger birds stay further north. And so it's clearly that they wouldn't necessarily stay in the same spot the first year. But, and I guess, I don't know if we have enough resightings to look at where the initial bandings older birds, and so this is their place, or are we seeing more consistency with them, or are we just seeing a pretty even mix of hatchier birds also showing up in the same places they had been before?
Yeah, we need to look at that a little more. I would have expected that it would definitely be the adult that we banded as an adult would have higher probability of being resighted in the same spot, and I think that's probably true maybe, but I know for sure that we've had quite a few that we did band as young birds that we did get returned yeah. to that same spot. So, yeah, how can both things be true that they're partitioning out and they have high site fidelity? I don't know. Maybe the young, maybe some of them figure it out the first year,
right.
and some of them
this
don't.
Is a good spot.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, it is interesting to consider. You know, another option would be that the ones that we're seeing resightings of are actually closer to resident. Because there's a lot of juncos are nesting from shoreline to, well, not to summit, but to tree line, basically,
yep.
and just above tree line.
Yep.
And so they aren't really there much in this. So they're all coming downhill or moving south or whatever it is that they're doing. So I guess it seems somewhat plausible to me that there could be a difference between the longer distance migrants and that's what you're seeing partitioning versus the more kind of resident
that's
type
true
birds.
The birds that we got as young birds that returned could be more the resident type
yeah.
and that would be an explanation to sort of a two different things happening that we've observed
so. It would be interesting. I mean, it's hard to know where they all go, I guess.
Yeah.
Someday when we have micro cameras that transmit to the satellites or something.
Right. Yeah. Right now we're still in the primitive ages with bird banding of the passerines, just because they're small and you can't put a big old giant tag on them.
Yeah.
Even now the technology gets better and, you know, there are things like geolocators that are small and, you know, they register the lights. So within 150 kilometers, you can get where they went if you can recapture the bird
right.
and get that information. But geolocators are expensive, and it's much better for a super long distance migrant if you just want to know like a ballpark of where they went.
Yeah.
And those are small enough for juncos, but not much else is.
Yeah, I suppose the the geolocators, that's what brought Allison Nelson here, is that they had seen enough site fidelity with wintering birds that she went ahead and did a project with a limited number, and they got not all of them returned, but they got a number of returns and found that those Bay Area hermit thrushes were nesting in southeast Alaska.
Yeah.
Well, on one side. On the other side, they were nesting a little further south. It seemed
right.
like there
was
so a little bit of a jump.
So I think it was just the South Bay Area
right. yeah.
hermit thrushes that came to Alaska, and then the North Bay Area didn't go as far or something
right.
like this, which is, it's just kind of funny to me that that they would segregate that way, but
right.
but they did.
Well, it sounds like with all the different migration strategies, there's the jump ones where birds that are further south go further north and
right
and
the so lacks the hypothesis. So
yeah.
the farthest south bird in the winter is the farthest north within a population.
Yeah,
the farthest north in the summer.
So there's
and
that
it seems to be working pretty well. Like the more studies that happen.
Yeah.
Find that to be true.
And so, mm-hmm. and with the hermit thrushes, like that could be what's going on for those barrier birds, but there's also clearly a shift of, you know, the birds that are nesting in the Bay Area are wintering in Baja, California, as
yeah,
I understand.
So there's that whole other, there's like a whole other subspecies of hermit thrush that's got a totally different strategy right there.
Yeah.
Which is pretty fascinating.
And so they replace the wintering birds in the Bay Area
right,
in the summer.
Right, it's the same place, and
yeah.
yet you have different hermit thrushes throughout the year. Some of them think it's a great wintering place. Some of them think it's a great summering place. But for whatever reason, they don't. Nobody seems to stay right there. They got to move
yeah.
somewhere.
Well, it's kind of funny, and I guess they're given the seasons and the climate there, where you have, you know, warmer, drier summers than and a bird that's adapted. She said that in hand she can easily tell them apart.
They
you know,
look
just
they
by
actually look different.
Yeah, yeah, the way the bills are. And so there's adaptations for and these birds that are coming north here, and so their summer is in these cool climates and they go south, you know, it's easier to so that makes some sense to me, I guess. That is a kind of like, yeah, I wouldn't want to go to a hot desert,
yeah.
you know, when I'm acclimated to a nice, you know, moist, moderate environment.
Yep.
So maybe there's something along those lines. But the juncos, you know, they span North America. What is it, four or five different subspecies that they have?
Yeah.
And of course, we primarily have the Oregon juncos here with the slate color juncos and kind of some integrates coming in the wintertime. And it seems like there's actually been quite a bit of work done on juncos, not so much specifically in this area, but across North America.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of genetic work to separate out, and it's basically a post-glacial expansion when there was less ice and savanna and more forests. That's when the juncos really took off in different directions. And when each little group got to its own corner, they started differentiating a little bit. So you have these birds that have like a white wingtips, like in the Dakotas, and you have these some that have a really nice reddish back down in the Rockies and the Southwest. Yeah, they're somewhat different, but they can interbreed, so they're still the same species. It's really neat the way they differentiated, taking advantage of that forest.
Yeah,
the new forest.
Right. Yeah, they do seem to be. I mean, yeah, I guess I mostly see them associated with edges. I mean, I'll see them in the forest as well, but they're also like when I think of open areas where I see them, they're usually around the edge.
Yeah, and actually. You know, here in Southeast Alaska, where a forest is super dense, they are not an interior forest species, as in they want to be near the edge of maybe of a peat bog, a muskeg, or something like that. You know, so yes, they like forests, but not the deep, dark kind of closed canopy forest.
Right. Yeah.
There's plenty of gaps, you know, that they enjoy. And what's interesting is I don't think there's been a whole lot of genetics work actually on our sort of special thing, which is the mixing of the Oregons and the slate color, or this third kind of one that some people think is another subspecies, the Cis Montane. I don't think that's actually been studied enough genetically to like decide if it's a sustaining subspecies or just a constant breeding of the two types. So
yeah.
If you're a real geek, you're interested in that. And so we're still a little bit on the frontier of junco genetics up here. Nobody's really done that yet.
Well, I'm trying to, I think it was Paul Norwood who I don't remember if you've met, but I've had him as a guest on the show before, and he's interested in natural history, and has done trips out of, or a bicycle trip. They did the Golden Circle or something, or Triangle, whatever they call that, going from Haines to
Skagway via Whitehorse.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And was talking about watching the juncos going up Haines Highway.
Oh.
and like in Haines, they're Oregon juncos, but by the time you get into Yukon, they're slate colored. And
yep.
So somewhere there's a transition and trying to watch for.
Yeah, actually, last year when I went up to do the breeding bird survey in Haines, I tried to find that line and stand there and look at the juncos. And I actually took a number of photographs of some of these kind of mixed characteristic birds like we see here in Sitka.
Yeah.
But it was a little difficult actually to see where that line was. But right when you start going up the hill, just before the border crossing on the Haines Pass is where I found the most of those kind of mixy birds.
Interesting. Yeah. So there is a transition. I'm presuming that's a transition zone that goes all the way around the Coast Range. Yeah.
Right. All up in, right where kind of where the rain shadow starts, I think is about roughly where that line is.
Yeah. It makes me wonder what's driving that, I guess. It's not that hard to go a little further or not. Like, why is it that that's just not good country for me? And then there's that blend zone in between.
Yeah.
Presumably there's something genetic about it as well. But
and
the adaptations of being all dark versus brown and dark, you know. Well, it's still dark, but not all dark gray. And maybe there's advantages, or maybe there's not. Maybe that's just sort of a coincidental thing that happened to develop in these different subspecies. But
yeah, it does seem like the slate colors are adapted for that more kind of lighter colors, dry habitat, different rocks or whatever. And the Oregons, they're pretty swarthy, you know, they blend in really well down here in the rainforest. So yeah, there may be something in a junco that knows when he's not blending in that well.
yeah, you don't want to stick out there.
You don't want to stick out. There's a lot of hawks out there.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of fascinating. And, you know, the song sparrows, we haven't got nearly as many of those because they're not nearly so cooperative, being territorial in the winter. I mean, the juncos have, I guess it seems as though they have some kind of territory that they use, but it isn't territorial in the sense that it's the pattern that they go in rather than this is my area.
Right. Whereas they use a certain area, but they don't seem to defend a certain area, whereas song sparrows do.
Yeah. And throughout the winter, it's like I noticed it, especially in the fall, them kind of getting agitated. And I suspect there's a certain amount of migrants returning plus resident birds here. And they're like, it's both migrants fighting out with each other and also tangling with residents that are like,
and
okay,
they fight.
Yeah. What are we going to do? And I was surprised one time I saw them rolling on the ground, sort of aggressive on the seawalk down here. I was like, whoa, this was in August. So it was right around the time that late August, I think, or maybe it was early September, but right around the time the migrants are returning, and there was some singing and then a tussle. And yeah. I was like, oh, these guys are into it. But that's like prime territory. The song sparrows seem to love shrubby right along the beach so they can drop down and get snails or whatever they're eating down there.
Definitely a shoreline preference species. But the juncos will start, you know, get fighty
in the spring.
Yeah. Once they start singing, then that's when you start seeing those resident males fighting and tussling, even sometimes puffing out all of their head feathers, looking really big, glaring at each other.
They do seem to like the flocks get a little less friendly. Mm-hmm. Even in the winter, there's a lot of chatter, but it starts to seem like more aggressive chatter.
Yeah.
And then they start to disperse a little bit, not quite as many birds around as the spring goes on. But the song sparrows are one that seems, I mean, they also span North America and have an incredible diversity of forms.
Huge diversity, actually.
It's pretty crazy to look at a picture of a song sparrow from the East Coast, and they're, I think they're significantly smaller and much lighter than our birds here.
Yeah, very different color pattern.
And you know, people that come from elsewhere are like, that's a song sparrow. But it was funny. Right. I was out birding with a couple from Kodiak, Rich McIntosh and Molly. And they were like, oh, your song sparrows are small. I was like, well, you're the first people to say that.
compared to Kodiak,
Kodiak
they
apparently
are small.
Has just monstrous song sparrows that are, you know, starting to get to be almost thrush size.
But someone from California will be like, what's that huge dark sparrow? Is that a fox? What is that? And then, no, it's not a fox sparrow. It's a song sparrow.
Song sparrow. And so, it's kind of incredible. They told me that the Kodiak birds are pretty resident. Like the ones on Kodiak seem to stay there all the time. But I know that, I mean, there's also birds on the Aleutians. I don't know how resident they are, but it seems like
you think they're resident. Just
resident on the Aleutians
as
well.
Yeah, I mean, I know they got there by flying, but they were probably lost and it's just not fun to leave an island in the winter, you know.
It's a long ways from anywhere there.
Yeah, I don't
I mean,
think
Kodiak's
they,
pretty far away,
I don't
too.
I think
so.
They leave, like, on purpose.
So the birds that are coming here, it seems like, if I'm remembering correctly, the presumed migrants tend to be a little bit larger and a bit darker than the more resident birds.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, and, you know, the measurements would be, but it's pretty subtle.
Yeah.
But maybe a little longer build, thicker build, and slightly bigger, darker.
Yeah. And those go, is that kind of form start in Yakutat or even a little south of there?
Yeah, I don't know exactly where the line would be, but probably right around Yakutat.
And then east Prince of William Sound and Kenai Peninsula, Alaska Peninsula as well? Or do you know?
Yeah, I think so.
So those birds, some of those, we don't know exactly where the song sparrow birds are going. They're so much more reliable, though, in terms of recaptures. I suppose they'd be one that a geolocator study might actually be worth trying
to do. Yeah, it would.
Because we had one that came back to our yard two years in a row and then went missing, presumably killed, in the second winter. You banded it the first winter. Came back two subsequent falls, and then that second one that it came back, it was gone within a month or two. We never saw it again. So whether a cat got it or what, I don't know. Hawk.
There's
plenty of dangers out there.
Roads, cars, windows.
But it's been interesting. And then it was nice to confirm we did at least two different song sparrows that were banded, were also nesting. One of them male because it was singing. And they were in my yard. I don't think the nest was in my yard, but they were regularly coming, and I saw them actually. I don't think the young one survived. There was just a single young bird, and they were, it was around the yard for a day or two, and then the male was singing again. And, oh. And I think they went to nest elsewhere and try again. But yeah, it was interesting to see that. And again, I guess the next question is, do we have some that move south in the, of course we wouldn't ban those in this season. We'd have to ban them in the summer.
That's the one that we would miss in the winter study, but yeah, they, since we seem to have some returning winter to winter, you could put a tag on them and maybe get them again. And it'd be interesting. And we've talked a little bit about isotope work that may be in the works if we have some student projects maybe coming up.
Yeah, that would be exciting.
You know, and that we could do different questions with the isotope. One thing would be to see just how attached to the shoreline they are. Like every birder knows that they're really attached to the shoreline, the seashore, and then lakes somewhat too. But, you know, it would be neat to see how much of their diet was marine related or close. You know, that's one thing you could do. As well as maybe get some geographic information. I guess I'm not that familiar with isotopic signatures in Alaska, how much it varies by watershed. Mm-hmm. But that would be the key, you know, whether you have a different kind of heavier hydrogen within the different bands of a latitude in Alaska, for instance.
I guess they have those rare isotopes. Rare isotope analysis, and then the carbon and nitrogen.
So there's different ways, elements you can look at. Yeah, the nitrogen would be probably the one you'd look at for the marine influence.
So that's one that I am curious about, in part because I know that because they are so territorial. Like the birds that's in my yard, for example. The ones that are resident, the one that I mentioned that came back two winters in a row, presumably it was going north. It may have been nesting along a shoreline somewhere, but it was wintering in my yard. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I'm far from the ocean, but I don't think it was going to the beach. Like I'm far enough. That it wasn't like just across the street. I think its territory was probably there. That's my guess. But it would be interesting to compare. Like we have upland song sparrows are hanging out in town. I don't see them away from town very much except along shorelines. Every once in a while I've seen, like I saw one along Indian River once and I was surprised, or in the forest once. Very rarely do I ever see them away from town or a shoreline.
Yeah.
But there's the ones in town that seem to be pretty territorial upland in their shrub thicket. And so it'd be interesting to just see, is there a signature there between that shows up between these shoreline birds?
Yeah, and I don't know how far away from the actual shore you need to be to get rid of the marine. I mean, it's a gradient, but how, like what you could detect.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, that's an interesting question. I had assumed that it had to do with what they're eating. And so, like, for example, if they're eating spruce seeds or terrestrial insects, that probably there wouldn't be much, if any, marine signature. But maybe I miss it. Maybe I don't. I mean, certainly I don't know, and maybe I'm wrong. But those song sparrows that are down, they look like they're eating snails.
Yeah, some of those song sparrows at the shore, at the actual beach, are probably eating little shrimpy things. Those, I don't know what you call them.
Oh, the amphipods.
They jump really fast when you lift up a big thing of seaweed.
Beach hoppers is what we used to call them.
Yeah, so they probably get something like that.
Yeah.
You see them picking around.
Yeah, for sure.
Right on the docks right in the seaweed. And
they seem to be like where the dock scrapes the piling. They seem to be picking in that stuff. So it's the like the barnacle mash and that kind of stuff sometimes.
Yeah, and you do get some song sparrows that their territory seems to be like a harbor, and you'll see them out on the docks. They'll be hanging out on, if a certain boat is there all winter in Juneau, like they'll I've seen them with kind of like, oh, there's that sparrow on that boat again. You know, they hang out there, sing from the mast or whatever.
Yeah, there are some. I think there are some that are out on the far fingers of Lake Eliason, so at least 100 yards from shore. Mm-hmm. So they're way out there on this, and they're probably not going back to shore. There are definitely some in Crescent Harbor where I've seen them going back and forth between the harbor, you know, the float and the shore. So they seem to be utilizing both.
Right.
But that would be another interesting thing to to tease out, because unless somebody's feeding, and I know that there are people that live on boats that sometimes feed birds.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know how often it happens.
I guess,
but
why
I've talked
not?
To
there's
people
there's
in the
a
past,
bird
yeah.
in their quote unquote yard
yeah,
on the dock.
So, do a little bit, but
well, hummingbird feeders I have
right.
seen on boats.
Oh yeah, yeah. They seem to be a little less discriminate about where they go to to find their food. But it would be interesting to, you know, compare one of those what seems to be purely harbor birds, so presumably getting entirely marine derived nutrients, versus a shore bird, a shoreline bird, where I would guess that it's getting some stuff from terrestrial. But again, I don't know how fast, you know, how fast that shift happens.
Right.
So it could use a little more investigation to understand at least how that shows up. And then the birds that are eating a lot of food at a feeding station would presumably
that
have
might
the,
throw
the
it
signature
off a little
of the,
bit. Yeah, yeah, about so, like a signature of Indiana or wherever
right,
they
or
grow
definitely,
millet.
Yeah, yeah,
the
corn-fed birds.
Yeah,
yeah. But definitely a terrestrial well, signature
so,
at that point.
Actually, though, so the feathers usually, if it's an adult bird, or even a young bird, they're going to grow. They're going to molt that feather somewhere near the nesting area. Mm. So. Unless you had a feeder up there,
right.
you'd be getting the feather that was grown somewhere close to the nest.
Okay.
In the young bird case, in the nest. But the adults are probably going to molt, you know, a few weeks after they're done nesting. But some birds actually go that are quote unquote summer molters will actually go to a specific place just to molt that is either a short distance or a pretty darn long distance from the nest. There's now kind of this new emerging study on the what they call molt migrants. So they have a wintering spot and they have a breeding spot, and they also have a very specific special molting spot that might be halfway in between or part of the way. It may just be a different habitat that they go to.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that. Mostly about waterfowl and like geese, and like I think there's some big stopovers for those. But then,
it's songbirds too.
Yeah,
they
I remember
very
hearing
specific
somebody
molting places, possibly
in Colorado. I think talking about maybe chipping sparrows showing up at a certain time of year, mm-hmm. and that it seemed to be kind of a and they were quiet. You know, people didn't report them very often. Because they weren't out, but it
right.
seemed to be
so that's
a
banding
thing.
Studies are kind of picking that up a lot more than standard bird watching because, yeah, the molting bird is very quiet. They're not going to advertise themselves because they're very vulnerable. Both because maybe they can't fly as well if they're missing some flight feathers. They're not as extreme as waterfowl where they, you know, they can't fly at all. You don't get that in songbirds, but maybe they're slightly compromised flying with a few less feathers. And then they're under a lot of pressure growing those new feathers nutritionally, so they don't really have the energy to go around singing and defending a territory. So they tend to be really inconspicuous.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess they lead full lives. That it's funny. It's easy to not really think about, like, oh, they got a lot going on that I just don't have any real awareness of because it's happening out of my obvious sight or awareness,
yeah.
You know, and to think, oh, that is one of the fascinating things to, like, you see a bird, whatever kind of bird, and think, boy, every day it's got to be out there figuring out, you know, what to eat, how to avoid getting eaten, and then it's moving around, you know, on these yearly cycles, and it's, I mean, just even some of the daily cycles of the juncos are that I've seen raise more questions than answers for me. You know, there's a pattern of them moving past my house in the evening, and if I happen to be up early enough watching, I see them coming back from that. So presumably they're going to some sort of general roosting area, and it's been the same for as long as I've lived in this house. So now 8 years, it's consistent that they're all going something about that the juncos like. And it makes me wonder because so many of them are young birds, right? So it's like, are they following the old birds?
Yeah.
Or is this just like juncos, this is what juncos like to do,
yeah,
and so they're
it's
juncos.
It's just an instinct, yeah. Like, oh, that looks like a good place, and they figure it out on their own.
Yeah.
I saw that a little bit. I studied California condors for a year in a monitoring program in Southern California, and we had newly released young condors that they grew up in a zoo, so normally that is a bird that probably did get a lot of parental attention. They would only have a young every couple of years, and the young would follow the parents around learning where the good feeding places, roosting places were, whatever. Well, these birds didn't have that. We were the surrogate parents by putting food out farther and farther away from where we released them so that they could explore and know where to look. But it was interesting how often they would discover a place that in the old records had been known as like a condor roost or a favored place of condors. There would be some instinct of like, that looks like what we like for whatever reason. Yeah. And they would choose that place over other places.
I guess, I mean, people probably aren't any different. You know, you get to a place where there's a nice view or there's a certain kind of shelter there and you're like, oh yeah. And then you find somebody else's camp there.
Oh, you know? Definitely. Like, you see that on trails all the time. Or that looks interesting. Maybe I'll walk up there. Oh, look at this. There's this little tiny user created trail that goes up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not so different.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of funny. So, well, and you mentioned that you were doing breeding bird survey in Haines. And I know that I don't know. I guess I don't know what your full suite of breeding bird surveys are, but you have various other projects going on in Southeast Alaska besides just the winter bird project here. This seems like actually a little bit of an add-on for you that just come over and help us out. So, yeah, I'd be curious to hear a little bit about some of the other studies or ongoing work that you get to do in Southeast.
Yeah, well, for a long time I did the Alaska land bird monitoring surveys for the Tongass, and that allowed me to be everywhere from Yakutat all the way down to Prince of Wales Island at times, or sending crews around. So that study, we're taking a little bit of a break, looking at data, maybe hoping for a little more funding, and...
It's a little expensive getting around Southeast Alaska.
It is, and it's getting more than so all of the time. We have a really good long-term, about 15-year data set from that for the Tongass.
Are these all the same points?
Yeah, they're point count surveys, so they're scattered around the forest, but then you have a grid that you return to every 2 years, and so it's a little different than the breeding bird survey. But it's a very... rigorous protocol so that you're getting the distance to each bird as well as identifying all the birds there. And so there's that survey, and then the standard breeding bird surveys, which I actually do the ones up in Yakutat, and then now I picked up Haines.
So you're no stranger to those early mornings.
No, yeah, definitely not. They all require getting up really early.
Yeah, the Sitka one is 3:29, I think, is always the official target start time.
You start right at sunrise, official sunrise, which if you have to drive a ways or walk a ways, then you're getting up really early.
So the one in Sitka, I drive to the starting point, but I actually have to walk the last half mile or so.
Oh, wow.
Once the road is done out the other, you know, at Catlianne, it would actually be possible to drive a full 25 miles in a line instead of all these little side trips that have to go on now.
Oh, wow.
So I was considering whether that they would just checking in and saying, hey, we could actually revise this. So, of course, then it's going to change all the comparison
and
stuff.
But. Usually you don't want to change anything unless there's a real reason that your route has become untenable, like you can't get there, or you can't hear anything because there's so much traffic and that kind of thing. But other surveys I've been involved with, well, I do have the Rufous Hummingbird banding, and that's in the summer in Juneau. And I am president of the Audubon Society, as we talked about earlier, and the Audubon Society has a tree swallow nest box monitoring program, and I don't personally do much of that work. It's kind of helping make sure that it happens. Brenda Wright runs that. And along with a lot of citizen science community members, and then we also normally try to have a college-age intern help with some of that stuff, mostly with the tree swallows. And then I monitor seabirds somewhat, and we have with the Forest Service, a monitoring program of the Arctic terns and other seabirds around Mendenhall Lake. Usually get the Audubon intern involved in that too. So,
on the tree swallow study, so So you set up nest boxes and then just check for survival rates, or?
Yeah, so it's actually a statewide network where quite a few communities have boxes and someone managing the box or monitoring the boxes.
Right.
So it started up at the most emphasis has been up at Creamers Field and Fairbanks with the it was the Alaska Bird Observatory, now the Alaska Songbird Institute running them. So they have a really big program where they have school age kids involved, and they do banding, and it's quite a rigorous monitoring program. And then other stations are a little less intense. But there's some on a couple of the military bases. King Salmon, Alaska, has a bunch of them. There's some around Anchorage and University Alaska up there. There's one professor that's interested in it. So we're the we have some there. There have been some other southeast set up, like down on POW and Gustavus. But I think Juneau's the only part of that, like the network at this point. And so we have about 50 boxes.
Oh, wow. How many of them get used in a given year?
It's more every year. Oh. It's kind of field of dreams with swallows. Like if you build it, they will come. So they discover them. And so you do tend to get, I don't know where you max out. It takes quite a few years, but we're still probably, we may have maxed out. We're probably still in the building stage. So I want to say that 38 of them were occupied this year. Quite a few.
Are those all spread around on the wetlands or?
Yeah, so there's some on the Mendenhall wetlands, and then there's some over on the other side of Mendenhall wetlands on Douglas Island, the Fish Creek area. And there's some, there were some near the Pioneer home, kind of the Costco Lemon Creek zone, although a bear took out some of those. Oh. So those are moving. We've got some out by the community garden. So yeah, they're scattered around, but mostly in open wetland areas, you know, which is what swallows like.
Right. What would be interesting? I mean, I guess if somebody's feeling spread, I know that there's, I can think of at least two or three people, including my son, who have put up nest boxes just around their house.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had 1 year chickadees nested, and chickadees are kind of bullies.
They
didn't like tree swallows around, and despite being much smaller, they chased out the tree swallows. But we did have tree swallows nest. He's put up two boxes, and they'll look at both of them, and they'll choose one of them. I think they're close enough that it would be a no-go for a
Yeah, they need
pair.
To be set up. There's actually a protocol that they need to be, I think it's at least 100 feet. It may even be farther than that, or they'll fight. Like,
right.
So you can't have them that packed together.
It was interesting, though, to watch the swallows would, they were tied onto the railing of my deck, and the swallows would come if I, they didn't like me being too close.
Mm-hmm.
But if they weren't around, he built it so he could lift the top, and we could peek in, and they're all, like the babies are just all tucked in there. There's like four babies one time, and they were just in there. And then one year, I was watching, and I didn't see any of them jump out, but I was watching them in the morning, and then in the afternoon they were gone.
Oh,
so
wow.
That was
it,
like,
was fledging
they
day.
They were kind of poking their head out, and then they didn't really come back. But yeah, it was kind of fun. Tree swallow boxes are not difficult to build. You want to make sure the hole's small enough, I think, to avoid the starlings from
getting in there. So we followed, there's actually an established protocol for North America. It's called Golondrinas, which means swallows in Spanish. And it started on the East Coast with actually affiliated, I believe, with Cornell. And there's been quite a bit of research. And the reason why swallows. So there's a lot of concern about aerial insectivores. And it was proposed as a species that we could study a little more intensely than some of the flycatchers, which are pretty hard to study, to look at things like changes in arrival dates, changes in fledging dates, laying dates, you know, possible mismatches between the insects that they eat. So those are the kind of the questions that the Alaska Tree Swallow Network is going to try to answer.
Mm.
And there's actually probably going to be a graduate student starting maybe next year looking at some of the data that we've gathered, and hopefully that'll lead to some insights. But what I can say just at the face of it is that Alaska's going to be pretty hard because it's pretty – seems to be a lot of variability between years and between
mm-hmm.
sites.
Yeah.
You know, because our climate is so crazy in the spring – you know, can it can arrive at different times or a pretty big span. It's like between years and between places in Alaska. So that's going to be maybe take a little longer to nail
right.
down
I remember
questions like that.
A year, no, it was probably 2012, I guess, when the Swallows just gave up ship. They're just like, this isn't working. And by I think June, they were gone by the end of June. We just didn't see any tree swallows anymore that year. I guess they just decided nesting wasn't really worth the effort.
Yeah,
this
it just
year.
Wasn't working out, not enough bugs or whatever.
And they just left. Yeah, and 2012 was a pretty cool summer, but that makes me wonder about, you know, as we 2012 was a year that the snow took a long time to melt off in the Alpine, for example. It was not, like, it didn't strike me as being particularly cold, but it was cool and rainy. And I don't remember that it had been an especially hard winter the winter before, but for whatever reason, yeah, and I can't swear that was the year that the tree swallows disappeared, but I think it was. And I guess in the, you know, the old days, 100 years ago or whatever, when climate was a bit cooler, coming out of the Little Ice Age in particular, maybe life was a lot harder for tree swallows and they weren't so common here. But most years they seem to do great, and they're fun to watch. And here, Swan Lake is a place where it's interesting, they're there and there'll be a bunch of them there and then they won't be any of them there. But if you walk around the neighborhoods, they're just flying around the neighborhoods. And so they definitely concentrate at Swan Lake from time to time, mm-hmm. but they're using a lot of other territory as well, it seems like.
Yeah. So. Well, they follow the flock, the swarms of bugs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. So, well, and I know with the Audubon there, you also, one of the things I've noticed and taken advantage of a couple times is that you do have talks there, which are live streamed on Facebook at times.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and that's a good thing for folks to know about. I know there's been a lot of frustration when we send out a newsletter saying, hey, we're going to have this great talk in Juneau, and we have a lot of members in other communities that are like, well, that's cool. But now they're on Facebook, so if you just search for Juneau Audubon Society if you're on Facebook, even if you're not a normal Facebook user, you can still watch it. Like, you don't have to be like, I don't know. You don't have to go over to the dark side of social media to get on there and watch our video. You can just find our page, scroll down and see the latest talk on there. So the last one we had was really interesting. It was about Aleutian terns and Sanjay Piyari with the University of Alaska Southeast had a Fulbright fellowship to go down to Indonesia where the Aleutian terns go and interact with people down there and find out more about the habitat those birds are using in the winter. So very cool talk.
Nice. Yeah. And the archives are available there as well. So if you're a member of Juneau Audubon or not, you can go to Facebook and find the Juneau Audubon Society. You do those once a month? Is that kind of the target?
Yeah, it's once a month in the fall, winter, and spring. So we take May, June, July, and August off, and the rest of the months once a month, second Thursday. So look on Facebook after that.
All right. Well, thanks, Gwen. And as we're wrapping up here, is there anything else you want to mention before we finish?
Well, just to remind everyone in Sitka and actually everyone in Southeast to look closely at the juncos at your feeder in case they've got bands on them. And please look at sitkanature.org on reporting those bands, please.
Yes. If
Lots
you
of
see
colors.
Them, it's great if you can get a picture. If not, we need to know what colors and which one's on top, which one's on the bottom. There could be as many as four bands.
Yes.
We'd be definitely interested to hear. We found one so far in Juneau. Who knows where else they might be going, but definitely interested. Well, thanks, Gwen.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with Gwen Bayless. She was in town for the 8th season of bird banding in the Sitka Bird Banding Project, focused on dark-eyed juncos, chestnut-backed chickadees, and song sparrows, each of them getting a unique color band combination. And if you see any of these birds with color bands, we'd love to hear about it. You can just record which legs, left and right, have which colors. We need to know the upper and the lower color. Sometimes they only have one, and occasionally they don't have any on a given leg, but just record that information, or even better, get a picture. Send it to me at sitkanature@gmail.com, and I can let you know where that bird was banded and when. And that information will contribute to what we're learning about these songbirds that are wintering in Sitka. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there more generally as well. You can send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. You can also find archives of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.